Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Dr. Barry Lyka, who is the author of Don't Choose a Cosmetic Surgeon Without Me, Your Complete Guide to Finding the Perfect Cosmetic Doctor. Dr. Lyka is also the author of several other books, including Shaping a New Image, Restoring Youth, and Skin Works, How to Restore and Keep Your Natural Beauty, and more recently, a book on liposuction. Dr. Lyka has a radio show, which I've actually been on a couple of times, and he probably draws a lot of his knowledge in this book from that radio show, and therefore the book has some very excellent information about what you need to consider when choosing a cosmetic surgeon. Thanks, Dr. Lyka, for joining us today.
Susan, thank you so much for having me. I love being on the radio, and I love to be able to educate our listeners. You know, we're in the communication day in this day and age, and I think it's very important to communicate about the important things in cosmetic surgery.
So, Dr. Lyka, how long have you been doing your radio show inside? It's inside Cosmetic Surgery, right?
It's in Cosmetic Surgery Today,
right?
And it's been around now for about 5 years. And right now we have about 5,000 downloads a week on my show. So we're growing by leaps and bounds. And the reason why it's growing is because the listener is really interested in cosmetic surgery procedures. I think cosmetic surgery is on everybody's mind these days, and it's something that we need to communicate well on, because there's a lot of charlatans out there.
Yeah, and as you say in your book, Don't Choose a Cosmetic Surgeon Without Me, the tabloids as well as the more glamour magazines love to put stories forth about celebrities with botched cosmetic surgery. So, and you do a very good analysis of that in your book.
Well, but you know, the number one determinant of how your cosmetic surgery is going to proceed is your choice of your cosmetic doctor. So you got to do that carefully.
True. That's true. And it seems that once someone has had an adverse result from the surgery, if they're related to a famous person or if they're a famous person, then all sorts of stuff, including rumors, start circulating everywhere and kind of puts an abnormal fear of cosmetic surgery out into the public. It seems to me that that they sensationalize it quite a bit, and then
if it bleeds, it leads. And that's
right.
The whole thing about the news world. They have to sensationalize for people to listen. Unfortunately,
yeah.
That is not the reality of the situation. Yes, mistakes happen in cosmetic surgery. Yes, there are bad doctors out there. But, you know, 98% of all cosmetic surgeries go exactly as planned. They go exactly as doctors want them. If complications happen, the doctors manage them well, and that means there's a good result at the end of them.
Now, in your book, you talk about searching for a really good cosmetic surgeon, and you talk about the qualities that you want to look for. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the qualities?
You know, I would love to do that, because I think the most important thing is to choose the best doctor. And some of the best things are not self-evident. You know, most people think one cosmetic doctor is as good as another. Nothing could be farther from the truth. Cosmetic doctors are all grades and skills. It's like athletes, for example. One athlete might be a great pass receiver. Another one might be a great running back. And there are grades of running backs. There are some that are superlative at what they do and others that are mediocre at what they do. There are quarterbacks that are so good that everybody wants them. And then there's other quarterbacks that nobody wants them. And the key for you as your listeners out there is to get the best doctor. They have to look for certain things in doctors. And some of them are not really self-evident. You know, one trait I think you should look for in a doctor is curiosity. And the best doctors have what I call an insatiable curiosity. They're always wanting to look under the hood, so to speak. It's almost a hunger that they have to fill. I've worked with some of those doctors, and it's something that the best doctors are always looking at. You know, it's probably like you, Susan, when you're doing a breast lift operation, you're looking for not just an ordinary breast lift procedure. You're looking how you can tweak this and make it better. You're looking how you can keep the complications down, keep those infections down, keep those things that are going to undermine the procedure down to a minimum, mm-hmm. and keep away from the hazards of the procedure as well. And I think that is really the insatiable quality that I'm looking at in that, is that these doctors are also just curious on how to make the procedure better. They're not happy with the mundane.
Yeah, I had a surgeon the other day watching us do a breast lift after an explant. And as you know, when you take breast implants out, they have a whole other problem than, you know, normal natural aging breasts have. And we did a number of maneuvers, this, that, and the other. And the surgeon commented that he'd never seen or heard of what we were doing, because we actually had to come up with stuff that probably at least has never been published, because we have a problem that's much more severe than the normal problems.
Well, that's right. And closely related to this is doctors who are great at doing this. They're the seekers of greater knowledge. They want to know everything about an area. They want to be able to command that area. They want to really mm-hmm. know every little nuisance of the area. So in breasts, you really want to know everything there is to know, from fixing that explant to implanting a new one and how to make it better
right.
for people.
That's true. And you know, the idea that when you have a significant problem, your creative ability comes in and you can bring in the answer.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, you can create the answer from that which it's your past experience, but also you can bring to you, and you and I can do this through our radio show, because we can interview people. I went out and interviewed all these people to determine how to get silicone out of the body. You know, I didn't know how to get silicone out of the body, so I turned to functional medicine. I turned to detoxification. When I called the clinics, they wouldn't talk to me, but when I had them on the radio show, they talked to me no problem.
Well, you know, and I think that's part of the reason why I do a radio show and you do a radio show, is we get
yeah.
the best of people that way. We're able
we
to
do.
Open doors that we couldn't do. I'll give an example. You know, I'm a big expert in scar correction these days, and the reason I became an expert is because no one was mm-hmm. an expert in it. So I bought these expensive lasers, and then I had to learn how to use them. And most
mm-hmm.
of the stuff was being done in the military in the United States, and they didn't want to give their secrets out. But I
right.
had them on my radio show, and I was able
there
then to
go.
Get into the door and,
right.
and learn the fanciest, best ways to learn these great tools. And so in the last couple of years, I've become an expert on scar correction, largely stepping on the shoulders of the giants that are using it.
Mm-hmm. Right. I have a question for you, because I was reading through your book, and I noticed that you were talking about burn scar correction. I have a patient that had pretty severe burns all over his body, and we're at the point now where many of his scars are doing okay, but quite a number of his scars are red, raised, and not subject to treatment with silicone sheeting because he had an allergic reaction to it. We've done, you know, steroids. We've done scar excisions. We've even treated with antifungals and antibiotics. And when he's on the antifungals and antibiotics, including antifungal cream, he gets better. But, of course, you can't keep him on it,
no.
so he gets worse when we take him off. What would you do for him in terms of laser? And
What he needs is a consult with somebody that's an expert in fractional laser resurfacing.
You know, we have fractional lasers here, and Dr. Gordon is actually an expert. Dr. Wu had the IPL, Botox, and steroid combination.
Yeah,
is that something?
We use everything in combination. We use multiple lasers
okay.
in combination. But and many of them are used the same day at the same time. But
mm-hmm.
it's not just having the lasers. It's how you use them. And it's
okay.
like a great artist. You know, you want an artist that can combine all the colors in a way that you want to and make the great painting you want to. It's not mm-hmm. just having the paint brushes and the paints. It really is combining all this. And this is part art and part science. And it's a very advanced the way the fractional lasers are used. The best laser for this in my book is something called the ultrapulse laser by a company called Luminous, because they have different parameters. They drill tiny little holes into the skin. And through those holes, you can put in drugs. You can do other things as well. And the laser themselves, mm-hmm. this particular laser, turns type 1 collagen to type 3 collagen, which really is the best way for this scar to evolve and do the best thing. Now, I was trained by Jill Wabel in Miami, Florida, on the use of those, and she's a great resource in your area. She is really probably one of the best. In the Philadelphia area, I met a surgeon recently that is an expert in silicon, but also uses the fractional lasers. And I'll, mm-hmm. after the show, I'll drop you his name, because I think he would be a great resource for you. He's in the dermatology department in that area. And really, he's a really bright guy and has some great ideas about things.
Yeah, this, by the way, is a very, very serious problem. You know, many people who get burned, they also get contaminated at the time of the burn, or, you know, contaminated later because of decreased immune system. I used to work at the Brooke Army Burn Unit in the military, so I saw patients with even up to 93% total body surface area burns and took care of them when I was in the military. So these infected burn scars are just very, very difficult.
The key is to turn on the body's immune system, turn on their healing ability so it heals mm-hmm. in the proper way. And that's what the advanced lasers help us do, as long as they're used in the right parameters. See, the problem with the old lasers is they used to give too much energy, so they used to cause mm-hmm. the scar to get worse.
Right.
The lasers actually help us to do it in such a way that we're turning mm-hmm. on a different pathway through some of the factors that come out in the skin, some of the growth factors. And that seems to be the mechanism that we have to stimulate. It's a whole different pathway we're stimulating than we were before. And the earlier you get into a scar like this, the better the results. But it's also using the vascular lasers, which are turning off the redness. It's also using drugs like 5-fluorouracil and Kenalog into those scars to help them remodel.
Mm-hmm.
It's using all of this in combination, just like playing an orchestra, where you're using all the instruments to make a beautiful symphony. And as I say, it's as much art as it is science. And I was just at a conference in Boston, Massachusetts 2 weeks ago on the long weekend, learning some of the newer stuff. And again, we're pretty state-of-the-art, so I think we got most of the things down. And then just recently, I was in South Africa at the DASIL conference, where I was, again, commiserating with some of the world's experts on scar correction. And again, it really is becoming a forefront. The DASIL workshop is now trying to put together an international group of doctors, where we are putting together many doctors who can give advice on scars. And pictures can be taken, a doctor can be used in the area, and they can call on DASIL scar correction people as a resource for this. And again, we're doing this to try and break this scar down into something that will be better for people and make the world a better place.
Yeah, it's particularly difficult in nose surgery when you have scars that pull everything out of position. You know, you may have a great result initially, but if certain components of the nose are detached, and then the scar contracts, you can get that drooped tip.
And that's where two things are very important. One is surgical techniques such as the Z-plasty, but combining mm-hmm. it with the fractional lasers that remodel the scar. And the two together have to be used as more or less as one unit. And that is something that is becoming more and more evident now. You know, this is still the forefront. A lot of this is just being started to be written in journals right now. A lot of mm-hmm. this is still in seminars and in individual doctors' offices. It really isn't something that's common knowledge yet.
Yeah, what about the new techniques where they are using radio frequency, either externally or with the probes, you know, deep
well,
in the subcutaneous tissue.
What radio frequency does is it's just an energy force. It's just another
mm-hmm.
type of energy. So in itself, radio frequency doesn't do it all by itself. Many of the newer techniques are combining microneedling with the radio frequency, so you can actually input in little holes into the skin at the same time you're using a little bit of RF current. And the two together are working better than either alone. Because there's those tiny little holes, you can also put drugs in that'll make a difference as well. So really, it's combined treatments, and we're getting to a day and age where we're using multiple modalities all together to get the best results. The radio frequency techniques themselves are just simply stimulating the collagen a little bit to form a little bit better. In and of themselves, they're not very useful. They have to be used in combination with other items, as far as I've seen.
Yeah, we've got a RejuvaPen here, and they were saying that they've got some growth factors that can go into the little holes.
Growth factors are one of the things that can be done, and the growth factors are coming to the forefront. I still must say those are experimental at this time. We still don't know exactly how all the growth factors put together. For a long time, I've been using something called PRP, platelet-rich plasma, which stimulates a lot of the growth factors all at once, and those together are combined with it. But again, it depends on the type of scar, whether you want to stimulate a scar that's atrophic or depressed, or whether you want to take down a scar that's hypertrophic or active. So you really have to classify the scar first into its various components, break down the components, and then determine what needs to be done by the components. When I was at the DASL meeting, I proposed a 5-point plan for treating scars. One is to diagnose the scar. In other words, you draw a relief map of the scar, saying all the high points, all the low points, which are the parts that are hypertrophic, which are the parts that are atrophic. And so you put the right amount of power with each area. Second point thing you do is you treat any of the auxiliary problems. Many of the patients who have scars also have other things going on. Many of them will grow hairs in areas that weren't scars, called hypertrichosis, and that becomes a problem. Many patients will have hyperhidrosis in an area that a scar was in. In other words, they're sweating too much. And all those things have to be controlled in order for a scar to be improved properly. Third thing is then you have to put the right amount of, you might think about which combos can be brought to bear on this, whether it's massage, whether it's physiotherapy, whether it's diet, whether it's some of our modalities like lasers and drugs, all put together as a gamish to try and help us. Fourth thing we have to concentrate is on those contractures and releasing those contractures, in which we're using things like surgical elements to do that, like a Z-plasty and other things like that, again, combined with the elements I just spoke about. And last thing we got to worry about is the cosmesis and how it looks. And our whole goal is to get them to the premorbid state. Now, the word premorbid is terrible, and I hate to use that word. But to a doctor, what it means is that we're getting a person back to the state before the disease occurred.
Right. Recently, I operated on a patient who had multiple keloids, and I was surprised to find that in most of the areas of the keloids, there was cyst formation that was infected. That's something that, you know, we were taught in surgery school that if people have a certain genetic predisposition to form keloids, that that has to do with, you know, inability to get that collagen to mature, and they're just going to form keloids anytime they have anything. But what's so interesting to me is almost every place she had a keloid, she had a cyst formation. So I think it was the cyst that came first and the keloid second.
You know, it's interesting to state that because a lot of patients that I have and I'm treating keloids for, I uniformly put them on antibiotics right at the start of that. Again, being a dermatologist, we use antibiotics quite a bit for treating things. We're not averse to using antibiotics for treating acne, even for decades.
We've been
doing that forever. And I think antibiotics for me are useful for two means. One is they decrease bacteria, and second thing is they decrease inflammation. And I think two of those components are very important for scars. Inflammation seems to drive a scar on. So whether the cyst is infective or whether it's just got the inflammatory components of it that are driving the scar to form are very important to me.
Yes, these scars are, I really appreciate your expertise in this, because these scars can be just so difficult. And
well,
it's really great to get the
that...
idea of a dermatologist, you know, the ideas from a dermatologist, because
well, we
you've
think
got
of things
a
differently,
different perspective.
And I think it's very
yeah.
important to have multiple doctors working together. I really
yeah.
think the day and age of one doctor having all the knowledge in the world is gone. I think one doctor can be captain of the ship, but he has to really bring in ideas from everybody in this day and
mm-hmm.
age, because there's so many different ideas on how to handle things, so many different ways to handle them that are germane to the treatment process. And that's another trait of a great doctor, is doctors who are great like to share. They really don't mind sharing. They really like to be able to talk about the different things and bring in other ideas. They're not
mm-hmm.
threatened by them. They really find
right.
that what is good for one patient isn't necessarily good for another. And so they share their knowledge.
Yeah, you talk about masterminding, and that's one of the traits that you talk about, that having a doctor that wants to share and is willing to share rather than someone who's keeping everything secret, it's just better to have that kind of ethics and trait in a cosmetic surgeon.
Well, you know, we're all competitive creatures by nature, Susan, and we all do compete a little bit, but at the same time, we're also sharers, and I think it's very important for us to share in areas where we really can bring in better knowledge and bring all those things to bear. As I say, what is germane to one person's practice may be very germane to another, and these things have to be brought out over and over and over again.
So why don't you at this point give your contact information, including how folks get to listen to your radio show? And I'm sure you have archive shows like we do.
Yeah, we have a lot of archives, and there's a fount of information there on almost every topic of cosmetic surgery you can ever want to know. My phone number is 780-425-1212. I'm located in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. You can find me on my website at Barry Lyka, that's BarryLykamd.com. A lot of information there. My internet radio show is called Inside Cosmetic Surgery Today on webtalkradio.net. That's web, W-E-B, talk, T-A-L-K, .net. You can find a lot of shows, Inside Cosmetic Surgery Today. And there's some great shows that I've done with you, Susan, on that show. And I think those are some of the better interviews we've done.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate being on. There are a large number of women, and I'm not sure why, but it seems that there's a large number of women with problems with their breast implants in Canada. You know, maybe that it's just the closest country to the U.S. that, you know, they tend to contact me, but it's just very good to
have. Breast implants
have
been done here for a number of years. We've had silicone implants for a number of years. And as you know, mm-hmm. silicone implants have been a problem to a lot of people. You know, everybody thinks a breast implant is going to last forever. Well, they don't. They have a time-limited factor. Also, some of the early breast implants were not as good as the ones now, so they frequently cause problems as well. So I think it's important to realize that if you do have a problem with breast implants, your doctor might not be the one that's going to listen to you. He might have a vested interest in them, and so you might want to seek out some expertise elsewhere.
One of the things that I've found that I think doctors need to be educated on is when a foreign body gets infected, it doesn't form redness, pus, and the high white count that, say, soft tissue might, you know, cellulitis or an abscess. What it does, it just hurts. White count's usually normal. Sometimes the lymph nodes swell up, like in the axilla on a breast implant, and they're tender. But we don't see pus. We don't see. I had them do a CAT scan the other day on a patient looking for pus. Well, they didn't find any pus. They did find a pericardial effusion, which I'm very concerned because I know she has an infected chest wall. And I'm very concerned about any effusion around the heart that could get infected. That wouldn't be good. But it's just really amazing to me that ID doctors and plastic surgeons alike don't realize what the symptoms are in an infected foreign body.
Well, you know, in the old days, we used to be taught the four things that mean there's infections was Ruber, Kaller, Doler, and Tumor, the four hallmarks from the Latin language, meaning redness, pus, swelling, and tenderness. And those things do have some of the features that are present in an infection from a foreign body, such as tenderness and a bit of swelling. But certainly the Ruber and Kaller, the redness and pain, the Ruber and heat is the other thing, really doesn't mean there is those things are absent in this day and age. You know, so
I think what they forget, they forget that silicone is like a big splinter. Once it gets out of the implant and goes through the lymphatics into the lymph nodes, it's like a splinter throughout the breast. In the tissues and lymphatic system and along tissue planes, and all it does is it just gets infected and hurts. It doesn't form pus.
No, that's true, and I think that's what people will realize more and more as time goes on. But again, you got to listen to your patients, you know, and that's what I find sometimes is not the aspect in a doctor-patient relationship. The doctor has the knowledge, but the patient has the problem. And the two have to meet together, and that's where communication is a very important aspect. We really don't have as good communication as we used to have years ago.
Right. Well, patients are getting a lot of their information from the internet, from the doctors, from Dr. Oz, from, you know, all of the different things out there, and a lot of doctors get really defensive if they bring this information back into the office and start asking questions, because a lot of times the doctor has not researched the internet and has not watched the TV shows with the experts on them, and it's very threatening to them.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think people have to be cautious about where they get their information from, because not everything out there is bona fide fact. You know, I find certain shows are a bit sensationalistic, and they bring in sensationalism in order to sell the show. You just look at the headlines, for example. The headlines draw people in, and if the headlines aren't sensationalistic, people don't watch the show, so it becomes a double-edged sword.
Speaking of that, I just filmed my second Monsters Inside Me on Animal Planet. The first one in 2012 featured a black implant because there was aspergillus, you know, an amazing amount of aspergillus causing the saline to be black because the woman was put on antibiotics without antifungals for mastitis. But the second one that's going to air November 13th is about biotoxin disease. So although there were a little bit of aspergillus in the saline, they weren't black. They were just, you know, a little contaminated. But the biotoxin was making the patient deathly ill. And that's something that people need to understand, that there is something called biotoxins that can cause sick building syndrome. And when you have the implant in your chest wall, you just can't get out of the building. You carry the building around with you. So that's going to be educational for a lot of women who are considering breast implants.
Well, that is certainly true. You know, infections are something we have to be very cognizant of. And even though something doesn't look like it's infected when it goes in, doesn't mean it's not, you know. And something that can change over time. And that's the scenario that I think doctors have to be very aware of, is that things change. That what started at time A is not necessarily what's happening at time B.
Yeah, especially if they're exposed to mold. I had people breathing scuba diving equipment that had mold in it, and it got in their lungs and got in their breast implants. And, you know, the other thing that people need to be aware of is that if women have a penicillin allergy and have penicillium growing in the implant, when someone hugs them and squeezes the stuff out, they can have anaphylactic reactions. I had a couple of patients that had that. And so that's a really dangerous situation.
Absolutely.
To have a fungus growing in your breast implant that's producing something that you're allergic to.
Absolutely. And you know, allergy, you know, once a body gets an infection, the body changes. And, you know, the body reacts to it. It just doesn't sit there. It just doesn't lay back and say, oh, yeah, I've got this thing going on. The body starts doing things to change what's going on. And I think it's very important to realize the body is going to react with its immune system. And part of the immune system is what causes allergic features. Part of the immune system is what causes us to react to things in such a way to try and fight them off. But at the same time, it causes allergic-like symptoms going on in a person's body.
Yeah, and we learned through many years of experience, actually, that when the body walls off a foreign object, like a breast implant, and causes it to squeeze down, this capsular contracture, it's actually usually due to bacterial infection. So we call it subclinical infection because it doesn't have that pus and the fluid collection and the redness, but it still is an infection causing it. And that's a good example of what you just said. The body walls off something, and then if there's bacteria in that scar tissue, you get that capsular contracture.
Absolutely.
And a long time ago, I don't know whether you did this, but we did this, and you may have done this when you first started to put breast implants in. We were taking saline off the back table in syringes and injecting it in the implant rather than having a closed system. So if there were any mold spores in the room, that could land in that bowl of saline.
Well,
that isn't done anymore.
One thing that's happened over time is the systems have become much more closed, that you're not interjecting extraneous things going on now, that the systems are much better than they used to be, that the controls are much better than they used to be. Again, that took a little bit of learning and a bit of a learning curve that went on.
Right.
We're much better now in 2014 than we were in, you know, the 1990s regarding this. Again, we understand a bit more. We understand what's going on better. And I think a person now looking for breast implant surgery is much better off. I think they're going to get a better procedure, providing they choose their doctor wisely and the doctor listens to them. They choose a great doctor for doing so. I think they're going to be better off in finding the best procedure for them.
Yeah, one of the big problems that I've found is that doctors who don't see the complications don't understand. They may do a whole bunch of breast implants, but because they don't realize that these things exist, like valve defects that cause mold to be able to get in implants, or certain implants that are textured silicone that can flake off and increase the risk of lymphoma, a rare lymphoma. Because they don't see the complications, they don't understand which implants cause more problems. And I'm in a difficult position. You know, I see thousands of cases of problems, and then of course I get phone calls for probably another thousand, and I always ask them what kind of implants they have and how old they are and everything. So I actually know which implants are the safest, which are the most likely to cause problems. But I find it very difficult, like on the air, to be able to say anything for fear of, you know, action by the implant companies. You know, I mean, I know that what I'm seeing is true, because there's big numbers. You know, it's not just a 5% difference. It's like 95% of the problems are in one implant manufacturer. Okay, so you know that it really is true. But the FDA will not acknowledge this. The FDA will not study this. Large 90% of the textured implants are one company that are causing the lymphoma risk, and the FDA is only looking at one implant out of many implants, and then they say they can't tell what manufacturer it is. And I can't help but think that that's on purpose, so that particular company's implants won't need to be recalled. But the public is not going to get this information.
No, but again, I think for the consumer out there, the listener out there, I think it's, again, behooves the listener to talk to the doctors that are doing this, talk to them about what they plan to do, talk to them about the types of implants, talk to them about how much knowledge they have about the implant, talk to them about how long they've been doing this particular procedure, talk to them if they just think that implants are the greatest thing on the planet versus just another tool that we're using in our armamentarium to make a person look better and feel better. Because I think the doctor's answers will bear out whether they feel that they will work with them, whether they'll help them, whether they're choosing the something best in their interest. And that really is another skill of the greatest cosmetic doctors, is they're concerned about the patient in all respects.
Right.
They're not just concerned about their own, you know, this procedure is going to go well. They're concerned about whether it'll continue to do well for the next several years, whether it'll continue to do a great thing for them. And I think those are things that are really important in looking for a doctor. You really need to choose the doctor that has your best interest at heart in all respects.
Right, even if the doctor is going to tell you not to do the surgery.
Absolutely. And I think a word that doctors don't use enough is the word no. You know, we really want to help our patients, so we try to bend over backwards in many respects. But sometimes the best way of helping a person is to say, no, you shouldn't get it done. Really, this is not the best thing for you. Maybe we should be doing something else. Maybe we should be, for you particularly, we might be wanting to do some, harvest some fat and put some fat in that area. And maybe it would be better to do this. But again, a doctor must be trained in all aspects of the procedure in order to do that well.
And even though it's on the package insert, a lot of surgeons evidently don't read the package insert, and in breast implants anyway, because of this lack of research into why certain people react adversely, it does say on the package insert that if you have a family history or a history of autoimmune diseases, that you shouldn't get implants. Well, you know, there's an awful lot of autoimmune diseases out there, including MS and lupus and all sorts of things, even the skin manifestations of autoimmune disease that people may not realize are actually autoimmune disease, psoriasis. And surgeons are putting implants in these people, and then they're reacting adversely.
Well, yeah. And you know, one thing that I was taught way back when is even lupus could be an infectious disease, because when you do electron microscopy of a cell of a person that has lupus, you see little bacterial-like rods in them, which are not seen otherwise. So, you know, we're understanding a lot more about infection. We still don't have the whole handle on it. And we really have to understand a little bit more. We will understand more as time goes on. It's just very hard to get all that knowledge because the body doesn't reveal all its secrets at any given time.
Yeah, what I've found, though, because I've taken care of so many women, is that many autoimmune diseases are actually intracellular infections. They found the same, a researcher who wrote the book Cell Wall Deficient Forms found the same intracellular spirochete in 30 MS patients, but the U.S. government gave her a court order not to tell doctors. She was on my radio show. And many, many, at least half of rheumatoid arthritis is an intracellular mycoplasma. So I have a theory. And my theory is that once your immune system goes down, and of course there's many reasons your immune system goes down, especially T-cell immunity, you can get intracellular infections. Lyme's disease, mycoplasma, you know, there's a whole host of intracellular things that, including ALS and MS, that may be intracellular spirochetes. But you get these diseases because your immune system goes down. And then to put a foreign material in the body in a patient who has an immune system that's down is asking for trouble. So that's what I think you need to look at. And then for the biotoxin thing, if a woman has a previous history of fibromyalgia, that means she probably can't get rid of biotoxins, because mold biotoxins can't get rid 1/4 of the population can't get rid of the mold biotoxins. So most of us have been exposed to mold, and if you get the fibromyalgia-type symptoms, then you really need to think long and hard about putting saline implants in a woman that can't get rid of these biotoxins. So I think those are the two things that I would warn people about, that, you know, getting any foreign, it's actually any foreign material in your body, because breast implants are just one of many problems that people have. That any implant that you put in the body in someone who has an immune deficiency can get painful, and, you know, you can try to reject it. So that's the conclusions I came to.
I think it's very true. And you know, we are putting more and more foreign bodies into a person's body these days. You know, we are using filling substances that have long-lasting ability in their skin,
mm-hmm.
for example, and
yeah.
that has abilities with it. So again, to choose the right doctor that's going to choose the right material for you is
mm-hmm.
really, really important.
Yeah, and one of the things on Botox that I wanted to just let you know, the most people tolerate Botox pretty well, but if somebody has a whole bunch of neurotoxins from mold, biotoxins, one Botox treatment can put them in the bed for weeks. Isn't that interesting? It's happened to a number of my patients.
Well, that's interesting, but again, I think you're doing some fairly significant changes in a person. And what Botox is doing is it's interrupting the signal that goes from a nerve to a muscle. Now, in most
right.
cases, that's fairly localized. But again, it's doing a significant interruption of a normal process. So again,
mm-hmm.
I think other factors must be taken into account with that as well.
Well, I just think that if somebody has a whole bunch of neurotoxins in their body from mold, that putting another neurotoxin in your body might not be a great idea until you get rid of the ones you already have. I think that's probably what's going on. So
I want to do that.
Yeah,
there are a number of ways to do that. I mean, we have to take into account diet and other things such as supplements
sure.
and all those things in this day and age.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about what you think the future of breast augmentation and breast reconstruction might be, given that stem cell fat transfer is on the horizon.
You know, I think right now I've started to do some fat injections into the breast area, which really has been refined from the old techniques that we used to do, where we take
mm-hmm.
small amounts of fat and inject them sequentially to get a better result. Now, we're not putting it into the breast tissue itself. We're putting it between the skin and the breast tissue. So for people
mm-hmm.
with larger, that have a medium-sized breast and want to get larger, this is a great procedure. It's for women that really are in their 30s or 40s that are starting to get some drooping, because it helps in that
mm-hmm.
situation. It is a procedure where it does help some people, but again, it requires a good donor site, good fat, and stem cells are going to help, but I also have some worries about them too, because one thing that is so common in women is 1 out of 7 women is going to get breast cancer. And taking
yeah.
stem cells out, whether they'll turn into normal tissue or whether they'll turn into a cancerous growth is not known at this time. And we don't know all the factors that turn on cancer cells, and we don't know all the factors that turn them off. So I think we're exploring a new territory. I think it's going to take
mm-hmm.
at least 10 to 15 years to get a better understanding of all this. I think breakthroughs are going to come. We're going to understand this much better, but we don't have all the answers yet.
Yeah, I agree with you. We interviewed Dr. Danny Rudd on Temple of Health, and he pointed out that one doctor had treated stem cells with a calcium-type solution and evidently turned them on to make bone. So when that particular surgeon injected them in the periorbital area, they turned into bone and started threatening the patient's vision.
Well, as I say, we still don't know all the factors. It's interesting. In dermatology, we've been studying psoriasis for over 100 years. We are now getting
mm-hmm.
biological agents that are suppressing aspects of it. But we still
right.
don't know all the side effects of those biological agents. We still don't understand all the things that are coming to bear in it. And certainly,
mm-hmm.
you know, I find it fascinating that infection is a component, because in some patients with psoriasis, if we improve their digestive system, where toxins get into the body from their digestive system, we can improve their psoriasis markedly.
Yeah, there's something called leaky gut that occurs with what we call dysbiosis, or, you know, bad bacteria, fungus, and other parasite elements in the gut that cause great big things to get into the through the gut that normally can't get through the gut. And then there are circulating immune complexes that you can actually measure in the blood that may be a factor in some of the autoimmune disease, including psoriasis. So that probably has a great deal to do with, I mean, we're seeing a gut connection with autism and with all sorts of diseases that they didn't previously know that there was a gut connection to. And it may all be this, you know, this circulating immune complex causing problems all over the body, including the joints. It depends on where the immune complex ends up. So healing the gut is very, very important.
I think so. So going back to the thing about breast implants, you know, now we have better silicone implants than we had many years ago. We have ones that feel better. They are more acceptable to patients. They last longer. They seem to be better implants overall. We are understanding techniques of fat transplantation better because we understand what we're doing with it. We understand where it has to go, and we understand how fat cells behave. The future is nothing but rosy. I think what we're going to have is doctors that understand the system better, they understand things better, they're more honest, they communicate better with patients, they seem to understand a better way of doing it, and I think overall, over the years, we've been able to develop a better procedure.
Yeah, I think so, too. They actually have a saline implant in development. I'm not sure exactly where it is, but it's compartmentalized so that if you get a hole in one area, the whole thing doesn't deflate, which is an interesting idea.
That is an interesting idea. And the problem with saline implants up till now is it's been all or none. Either we have an implant that's working well. The biggest problem with saline is it still doesn't look or feel completely normal in a person. And so that's why people don't use as many saline implants as they do silicone implants.
True, but in women who have inability to process toxic chemicals because they have certain genetic defects like MTHFR, and there's other ones as well, but these women probably shouldn't get silicone because there is a small amount of gel bleed. I'm going to give you an opinion. This is only an opinion. But if you have a patient who needs a silicone implant because she has very thin tissue or is a breast reconstruction, and obviously saline doesn't look real good on a lot of those patients, I would recommend Sientra. Smooth silicone implants. The texturing, although it's great for shaped implants, does tend to flake off and get into the system so the immune system can react to it. But a smooth silicone Sientra implant, I believe, in my opinion, has less problems with it than any other silicone implant. That's just my two cents
worth. This is some of the advances we're talking about in this area.
Mm-hmm.
Sientra wasn't available a number of years ago. It wasn't even on the drawing boards a number of years ago. So again, another big advance in cosmetic surgery and in the knowledge of doctors in general.
Right, right. And again, you need to be healthy before you get implants. So someone who's coming out of a breast cancer treatment with chemo is not an ideal candidate to put an implant in. And someone,
isn't. Those are areas that we've been using fat transplantation for quite a while because
it's something
that is a better tool. It's a better material. It's natural. You don't reject your own fat.
And in the book, you mentioned something that I have also heard, and I don't understand why it occurs, but it's very interesting to me, that fat injection into radiated tissue, which is quite a problem on the chest wall, as you know, can really help the situation. That's something that is a little counterintuitive, but it's a great thing that it does work.
Well, we're starting to understand a lot more about fat transplantation. We're starting to understand that fat cells communicate with the skin cells and communicate mm-hmm. with the muscle as well. So that all the things work together to get a better result that way. And
right.
I think we are now understanding the materials, how they work, how they grow, how they change.
And I think we are transferring, especially if you do the harvest from the belly, we are transferring stem cells. And stem cells have got to help radiated areas. I think that is part of the answer.
I think stem cells are something we are doing it. There are two types of stem cells, those that are embryonic and the type that are in fat, which is quite different. But they seem to work in similar ways. And I think
mm-hmm.
that is something that's very important to realize, that stem cells have a big factor. Again, we don't understand everything about them. And it's probably going to take another 10 to 15 years to get our knowledge up to that level.
That's probably true. But hopefully it'll be faster, because we've got just a whole bunch of patients that are out there waiting for that information to solve serious problems.
I would hope so. The biggest problem is regulation, lawsuits, and
mm-hmm.
Problems like that. I think some of the biggest breakthroughs in those materials will come from other countries rather than our own.
I think that's true, too. Well, we're coming up at the end of our hour. Would you like to give the listeners any words of wisdom about your book, Don't Choose a Cosmetic Surgeon Without Me?
You know, it's a very difficult process to choose a cosmetic doctor. So at the end of my book, I put together a checklist, or really a
mm-hmm.
point system, where you can walk into a doctor's office and put together, just use the doctor index and choose and be able to grade a doctor. Go in with your eyes wide open. Use a checklist like this, because it will really help you to choose the best doctor for your cosmetic problems. Otherwise, you might be choosing the wrong doctor. And as I said at the beginning of this interview, the best doctor, the best determinant of your cosmetic surgery success is your choice of the doctor.
Oh, absolutely. That's very, very true. And the other thing is to, you know, to do what you can to improve your health, especially your immunity. You know, make sure that you don't have either hypercoagulability states or blood clotting too much or blood clotting not enough. A lot of the supplements that you're on may increase bleeding, so you need to get off of those, as well as, of course, common medications that increase bleeding. There's still an awfully lot of complications that occur because people are either bleeding too much or clotting too much. And, of course, the clotting too much is the one we fear the most with a pulmonary embolus from, you know, an elective cosmetic surgery. It doesn't play well.
And when you're choosing your cosmetic doctor, make sure that you don't necessarily have to choose the one in your community. I mean, there are, in this day and age, you don't have to be localized. You can move. The doctor that's probably best for you might not necessarily be the one in your own neighborhood.
That's true, too, especially if you live in the country. You don't have a lot of choices. The cosmetic surgeons tend to be in larger cities because of the demographics. So. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Like. I really appreciate it. And if you will get us your liposuction book, we'll get you back on to discuss liposuction.
Absolutely.
I have a funny liposuction story about myself. Dr. Gordon, we were in surgery one day, and he says, hey, they're going to bring in this Vasar system for me to try, and I only have one patient. He said, do you want me to do some on you? And I said, sure. So I got some experience as a patient. But I'd had lots of cosmetic surgery, Dr. Leica, and liposuction, that particular liposuction, made me realize that liposuction can be dangerous if you're not real healthy. So,
it can be a really dangerous.
It can be.
And at the same time, new systems are not necessarily the best thing to get
right.
Done.
I think the Vasar system is. I mean, I like our old tumescent system. You know, where we got very little side effects, very little downtime, very little pain, and And I was sitting there going, oh my goodness, I didn't realize that this was this painful. So anyway.
Yeah, the laser system is something that I looked at years ago.
Yeah,
and I discounted even before I started using it because it had more problems than I was happy to use. And
there
in some
you
hands
go.
It's been great, but in many hands it's been a difficult system.
I guess it depends on what you're doing. I had a localized fat deposit, you know, just abdomen, and probably just regular tumescent or smart lipo or something would have been a lot better.
Well, the system
I
use tumescent liposuction coupled with power-assisted liposuction using an instrument that literally vibrates the fat off rather than having to
manually take it
off.
We have that, too. Yeah, that's good.
And then I combine it with smart laser liposuction. And I also use a little bit of extrinsic ultrasound rather than intrinsic ultrasound because that helps to disperse the tumescent fluid better. So
I use
the combination of a number of different techniques that I found beneficial, but I also thrown out many techniques that I don't find beneficial as well.
Right. Well, anyway, I had a great surgeon, but we were doing an experiment on the machine, so that's a word of warning when you're choosing a cosmetic surgeon. Anyway, please check out Dr. Leica's Don't Choose a Cosmetic Surgeon Without Me. And thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Leica. I look forward to having you back on the liposuction book.
Susan, thank you. It was a lot of fun today. Have a great day.
All righty. Take care.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. This is Dr. Susan Kolb. Next week, we will have Aliens at My Fingertips, Real Meetings with Strange Beings by Saywood Iyer. And then Greg Braden will be back on the 14th of October, The Turning Point, Creating Resilience in a Time of Extremes. And then Stephanie Sorrell will be back talking about depression, understanding the black dog. Thank you very much for joining us for Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb. Join us next week.